from the thinkers of his own time. In fact, about this time, people like Kang Youwei and Liang Qichao had gone even further than Sun Yat-sen. And 4 years later, in 1898, they were able to push their ideas on the political stage during the 100 Days Reform. But by that time, Sun Yat-sen had undergone a transformation and had emerged in a totally different capacity. Let me now briefly touch on the stages in his transformation. This industrious and curious young student grew up in a rapidly changing world and absorbed the key ideas that were being debated at the time. For the first 28 years of his life, he read, argued, and digested what he learned without being sure what he wanted to do. He was still hopeful of doing the conventional thing and serving the regime of the time. But 1894 to 1895, well, that year was a fateful year of change for him. Soon after his letter to Li Hongzhang, from whom he probably did not expect a response, he abandoned his faith in the dominant political culture. Within a few months of that letter being sent, he had chosen a different road for what he wanted to do. He went to Honolulu and founded the Revived China Society, the Xin Zhong Hui. Then he returned to Hong Kong to plot the first of his Guangzhou rebellions. And when that failed, he became an outlaw. From that to his exile abroad, to his very dramatic escape from his government abductors in London, and then his consequent international fame, his life was indeed totally transformed. Now, all this is well known, and I need not detain you here. The point I want to make is that this was only the first of his transformations. Whenever one road was blocked, he moved to another. He was always ready to change himself and also his followers as quickly as necessary to meet a new set of challenges. And indeed, there were many challenges, and the challenges changed from time to time. But his vision for China remained the same. He wanted a united and sovereign state, free to build up its wealth and power and regain the respect of all other nations. That's what he wanted all his life. And towards this goal, he responded to China's defeat in the Sino-Japanese War, the failure of the 100 Days Reforms, and then the Boxer catastrophe and the imminent collapse of the Qing Dynasty. Each time, he did so with an alertness that qualifies him to be called the first modern professional politician, certainly that of China, and the first who consciously saw himself as a revolutionary. Now, this attitude towards the changeability of situations in a fluid world stayed with him till the end of his days. How was this attitude related to Chinese political culture? His peasant background was followed by his experience with his brother's overseas Chinese enterprise, who was in Hawaii. And it was also accompanied by a little Western learning, with a bit of Christianity thrown in, and then by immersion in modern medical science and an ongoing curiosity in every kind of knowledge that could help him, help China, to make China strong and therefore make the Chinese people proud again. What he did not get, however, was the respect that those with literati and Mandarin backgrounds could take for granted. When that became clear, he turned to more popular culture, the popular culture of the people he knew, the people who understood him. I refer to the descendants of the Taiping rebels, the secret societies that had long defied the Manchu rulers, his own Shangshan countrymen, and all the petty merchants, artisans, and workers that he met in Hong Kong and wherever he went. And among them, he began to innovate. He learned to address them directly and emotively. His eloquence soon became the hallmark of this early leadership. He could communicate orally what ordinary people wanted to hear, and did something that no literati intellectual thought necessary to do. This turn towards grassroots populism was new for any Chinese, newer perhaps than the actual messages that he brought. He talked about race and discrimination. He began to shape a new consciousness in some kind of modern nation for the Chinese, something comparable to the nations of Europe, America, and what was emerging in Japan. And not least, he wanted to replace the Confucian dynastic state altogether and came out with the idea of a republic for the Chinese. But this was a totally alien concept. But he managed to variously link it with an ancient notion of commonwealth, as well as a sort of brotherhood that his audience, that the traditional secret societies anyway, could understand. But it was far from clear that his supporters ever knew exactly what he had in mind, apart from the very simple fact that with a republic, we'll never have to have an emperor ever again. Now, these basic ideas were gradually elaborated as he gained experience as a revolutionary, and as he was challenged here and there and everywhere, in fact, by new ideas from the West, from Japan, and even among the literati leaders that he met, particularly those in Japan, students who've been sent to Japan, scholars who visited Japan, people who challenged him, who offered different ideas from the Chinese tradition. Now, he dealt with them. And in that context, his advantage, his one big advantage, quite early on, was that he had seen the most advanced countries of Europe and America and absorbed the new culture of modern politics by having traveled around in many, many countries before that period of exile in Japan. And by this I mean that he knew how to address the concerns of ordinary people and was increasingly able to articulate their wishes in ways that were totally unfamiliar to the literati intellectuals of his day. He was particularly successful when he went among his fellow Cantonese in Hawaii, United States, and Canada. But he was so effective as a political speaker that he could attract large crowds of non-Cantonese people too, in places like Singapore, Penang, and various towns in the Malay States. He stayed there altogether for nearly 3 years, off and on. Now, there is ample evidence to show how well he communicated. Just to give an example, on one hand, he alarmed the British authorities in the Malay States so much that they finally asked him to leave. It was just endangering the peace and quiet of the Malay States. On the other hand, he was so persuasive that we know some 30 working class Chinese from different parts of the Malay States and the Strait Settlements, most of them not Cantonese, but Hakka and Hokkien young men, went to fight for his cause in Guangzhou in 1911. I'm referring to the Huanghua Gang uprising. And these men, 30 or so, are now buried among the 72 martyrs in a very fine monument erected to their memory in the city of Guangzhou. But these men were persuaded through his speeches by Sun Yat-sen to fight for his cause.